Welcome to Just Another Wine Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon.
I'm Jamie Good.
I'm Doug Gregg.
Today we're talking about icons and unicorns.
We are indeed. And cult wines. I put that in brackets. These are three of my least favourite wine terms, as it will emerge. But we all have our different opinions. Icon wines. What does that mean? I think the word is overused and somewhat abused. So the original meaning of an icon is a religious image. An icon is a wine more... when we talk about iconic wines, and if we were to talk about them accurately, we talk about the label and what the label represents rather than the wine itself. And I find that quite frustrating because I believe that the label is one thing, but what's inside the bottle is everything that is important. And when we talk about unicorn wines, we talk about wines that are rare, where the demand outstrips this meagre supply, which are perhaps highly critically regarded and everyone wants to have them, but no one can have them. And therefore their reputation soars, particularly on things like social media, but also as a result of the auction market and the grey market. But before I sort of disappear down my own rabbit hole, I want to open out the discussion and ask Emily first, what do you understand by icon wine?
Icon wine. An icon wine, yeah, I think your point around it being a label or a name or a recognisable name. But I think it's more than just a label, actually. I think it is sometimes about what's in it. But however, because of the hype that surrounds it, the essence of the wine or the contents of the wine gets forgotten. So I would say that an icon wine simply for me would be a prestigious or a perceived prestigious wine or a perceived high quality wine that's maybe representative of something. So it could be that it could be an icon of a specific region. So let's say it's a certain producer making the best Gevrey Chambertin, almost like a reference producer, perhaps, but not necessarily, because that rule doesn't run far and wide. For example, for some people, like Opus One might be an icon wine. Would that necessarily be considered the best example of that region or an icon of that region? That's where it gets a little bit murky for me, and there's a grey area. I think there are some really intriguing icons, but also there's some very unintriguing icons.
Yeah, and in some ways I think, for me, icon is about the intent of the producer as well. A producer that's aiming to make a wine that is very high quality, but then they're looking to the luxury goods market rather than the geek market. I know that's a funny distinction there.
But do you think, like, for example, to challenge that as a theory, Dovizar as a producer, kind of an icon in Chablis, no?
Dovizar is an icon, but Dovizar is almost like, it's not a unicorn, but I think Dovizar is like recognised to be one of the very best in Chablis and consistently performs and is highly sought after. But I don't think there's any intent on the part of Dovizar to be like the most famous one. I think when we're going to icons, I wouldn't call that an icon wine. I'd say that was like a...
Who's the icon producer of Chablis then?
I don't think there are icon producers in Chablis. I mean, Ravenau and Dovizar are the two most famous, and that's what the rich Americans want, so the prices go up. But there's almost a bit of the unicorn about that, in the sense that demand and supply of being is what pushing the pricing up rather than the intent of the producer.
But there's a grey area where they kind of blur into each other.
So let's take concepts, this. Let's go away from the grey area to pick on some examples of icon wines and discuss those. And I think one great example would be Dom Pérignon. So Dom Pérignon, you've got a wine that's packaged in a way that's instantly recognisable. It's produced in large quantities so that the pricing is not driven by supply and demand. The pricing is driven by the intention of the producer, LVMH, to put Dom Pérignon is not the most expensive wine in Champagne, but it's an expensive at that icon level. Produced in quite large quantities, and it's the sort of wine that people who don't know much about wine would recognise. And if you see it on the table, you recognise that someone's a high baller because they've got a bottle of Dom on the table. And that's, I think, a really good example of a of an icon wine. If you go to California, then I think Screaming Eagle or
Harlan Estate
would be the icon sort of wines, because they're super expensive. They're good quality, of course. But then Doug mentioned the idea of the quality in the label. But sometimes the label changes our perception of the wine itself. So if we think this is a very famous and prestigious wine, that will not only bias us in our analysis of the wine, but actually as we drink the wine, our perception is changed by the knowledge that this is a very high quality, high status wine. But then you see this in Bordeaux with the first growths. I think they would be seen as icon wines. And of course, now the first growths, if you go to Primeur Week, they won't let you taste the wine blind. You know, you've got all the fancy chateaus, and not just the first growths, the fancy, ambitious chateau in Bordeaux make you go there to taste the wine. So you get the stage managed experience. It's not necessarily just about what's the liquid in the bottle. It's about the stuff around it. And they're not leaving anything to chance there. You know what you're tasting when you taste it. Other examples of icon wines, well, in Champagne, there's quite a few. You know, it's almost like a tier of Champagne now. It's a prestige cuvee is designed to be the icon wine and set out with the intention of the producer putting a high price tag on it. You know, whether or not there's market demand for that, there's an almost intention at the beginning to put a high price tag on it to make it an icon.
So this was almost aspirational, like buying into the aspiration of the product.
Yeah.
For the consumer and for the producer, right? Like they're all, like it's something to be held up.
Well, it's wine playing in the luxury goods market.
Yeah.
And which is a very different market to, like, I mean, who buys a Rolex because of its ability to tell the time? Nobody, you know? You buy it because of the branding and the prestige of the brand.
You're right, Emily, about aspirational. You know, you buy Dom Perignon because you want to be seen to be drinking it. It's probably not something you just drink at home, out of sight, out of mind.
100%.
So it's associating yourself with a prestigious brand. But some of the other wines, some of these Californian or Super Californians or whatever, is that not associated with wanting to be near something rare? As well, you know, the Screaming Eagle, for example, I'm assuming there's not a lot of that knocking around. But to say that you have a bottle is like to say you've succeeded.
It's about status rather than scarcity with that particular wine.
Yeah.
To be a little bit provocative, are there any unintended icons? Is there such a thing then? Can you think of one?
Unintended icons? Well, I mean, you referred to some sort of shabby producers who don't actually set out to make, you know, wines which, I mean, they're trying to make the best possible wines they can and are highly uncompromising. And I think that amongst people who respect the amount of work that goes into making great wine, they have become iconic, but that wasn't the intention to create something like that. So the wines have a sort of certain immortality in their own right. But you're talking about something flashy that just becomes famous?
Well, I think I've got an example that would be, so back in 1955, I think it was, Max Schubert made the first vintage of Penfolds Grange. And this was, you know, in an era where Australian wine was dominated by fortifieds. And he kind of went to Bordeaux and looked at how they made wines and wanted to make a table wine that was high quality. And Grange, over the years, then developed this reputation as being a particularly fine wine. But even when I started out drinking wine in the mid to early 90s, Grange was not that expensive. It was £35 a bottle. In your local threshers, you could go and buy it.
Threshers.
I didn't, because I bought the Bin 389 at £11.99. I was a cheapskate, you know. But then suddenly in the mid 90s, suddenly what was effectively had developed a track record of aging well. You know, I've tried vintages from the 70s of beautiful wines. Suddenly took on a new life as a new company with a corporate mentality, you know, got hold of it, decided this was going to be a prestige icon wine. So suddenly the price went up quite considerably. Now it's about £700 a bottle. It's really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the same wine. Well, it's not the same wine. It's the concept behind it is still the same, multi-regional blend. But now it's much riper and bigger and more oomphy, and maybe won't age as well. But it's very famous now, and that's become a celebrity icon wine. And immediately,
do you think that's down to marketing?
I think that what happened is the wine was made as a premium wine, but it wasn't, as I say, you could buy it for £35 a bottle. in 1993 in the High Street in, you know, South London. And then suddenly it's gone to this position where it's now in rubbing shoulders with the rich and famous, and Penfolds are using luxury goods branding to advertise it. You know, they're taking the luxury goods route. There's even TV advertising for Penfolds now, you know. It's definitely been repositioned as an icon. Whereas initially, I think it was not necessarily thought of as being an icon. It's just the big company mentality is like, we can make lots of money out of this, and it's prestigious and it's famous.
What about a tiny estate like Chateau Le Pin in Pomerol that rose without trace? And you could buy vintages from the 70s at the time for under £10 a bottle. What made it soar into the stratosphere? Is it just critical approval? Do critics make wines? Or make the reputations of wines?
I think there was a period when Parker had the ability to be a king or queen maker. You know, he would like give a relatively unknown wine a very high score, and then suddenly it would become famous and sought after. Then later on in his career, his scores crept up like everyone's scores crept up. And then as he's kind of waned a little bit and lots of other critics came along as well, suddenly none of the critics really now has that ability to do what he did originally when he was starting out, which is to make something have really that famous influence with a very high score. Because everyone's dishing out high scores like, you know, candy these days.
It's but like I guess it's got to be, first of all, you need the, let's say, the PR approval, but then you also maybe need the demand, right? Like, for buying it, because you can get the acknowledgement from somebody rating it, but if people aren't following and actually buying it, are you going to put the price up?
I think that something like that, the pricing is following the market. And this is the classic Bordeaux way, I think, is what they're with Primeurs, which is why Primeurs are struggling now, is that they've always tried to make the margin that someone else can make on their product smaller. So they'll price to the point where there's not much of an upside for anyone else to make their resale margin. Yeah, the resale margin. And that's actually, I suppose it's clever in one way, but it's like it's killing Primeurs, because basically, you know, you can buy the same wine for the same price a few years after release, you know.
Isn't the perception that something is rare is also very powerful? I won't even just talk about Bordeaux, but I'll talk about something that was huge in my youth, which is Cloudy Bay Sauvignon.
Oh, yes.
And Cloudy Bay Sauvignon was considered to be, because it was on allocation, it was considered to be really difficult to get a hold of because you were allowed only just a certain few cases. But there was nearly a million bottles of this wine being made. If you bought it directly from the importer, it was like £7 a bottle, but you were buying it through middlemen or sort of, yeah, brokers almost, and it was like suddenly it was £20. Mm-hmm. And then restaurants thought, it's such an amazing wine because it's so expensive. They were marking it up 3 or 4 times even in those days. So suddenly the wines, that Sauvignon, New Zealand Marlborough Sauvignon was on a list for £70 in the 1990s. It's pretty extraordinary. But Is that part of marketing, but also part of perception of value or that something is perceived as rare, therefore it must be good because it's rare?
Yeah, or just maybe just a very basic concept of I get to try something that, like, it's the exclusivity piece, I think, that comes into that. Like, I get to be one of the few people that get to experience this thing. I'm privileged because of that, or I'm very lucky to have that. So I think it's like playing into that. Like, I mean, you know, when somebody gets a flight upgrade or access to a business class lounge or something that's unexpected, how special it feels, right? So I think it's this idea of feeling special because you're part of a limited few that get access to that. It's very capitalistic.
It's when something's being talked about. So I think Cloudy Bay is very interesting because I remember that because I was like, I was so amazed when I first tried it. It was like, this is actually quite different. This is actually a remarkable expression of Sauvignon. I was quite, you know, new to wine at this stage. And so, you know, we were really looking out for it. And the scarcity factor was a big draw because it's like, if you thought this is amazing wine, you just turn off and go and find the next amazing wine. There's lots of amazing wines around. But the fact that it was scarce made it, you want to get hold of it really badly. I think that scarcity is a real draw.
But it was a scarce brand, which is sort of quite ironic when you think about it, because brands, well, you alluded to this in Penfolds. Penfolds is a brand, and yet it's sort of like, it's Dom Perignon, it's a luxury brand. people want to be associated with it. In those days, of course, the word of mouth was really interesting. Nowadays, of course, we have social media and we're so exposed to wine that I'm wondering whether icons are less of an issue now, where there's so many great wines out there that we don't sort of confer exalted status, particularly to a some over the others.
I don't know. Maybe. I still think some get talked about. I remember also, it's not just wine. I remember there was a period where Montgomery cheddar was being talked about quite a lot. Neil's Yard was selling this Montgomery cheddar. It got in the newspaper.
Every restaurant,
it suddenly got in the newspaper. One newspaper, and then basically the news cycle picks it up. And when the news cycle picks something up, everyone wants some. And I remember they were standing on the street giving people a little taste of Montgomery cheddar. It was like very exciting. And the rest of it, now probably Montgomery cheddar, people have forgotten that it was famous for a while. It's still a fantastic cheddar. So this is spicy, sort of like almost exotic quality to it. But it's like, I think it's some wines suddenly have their 15 minutes of fame, and their Cloudy Bay now is still a little more expensive than other Sauvignon Blancs, but you can get hold as much as you want. You know, it's like that veneer of scarcity, whether it was real or invented, has disappeared.
My point of view on your question is that I think icons are still very relevant. I think they're less relevant in our wine sphere that we work in, because I think the sommelier world has grown a lot. And a lot of these brands and icons are maybe not so needed. And also, I think there is maybe a little bit less demand from consumers in certain parts of the world. Like if we look at East London, for example, like no one's going to be drinking any of those bottles or really interested in those bottles. They're going to be looking for weird stuff, right? Like, but I think there's still a lot of consumers. Like if we get onto the wine that we're going to open shortly... Yeah. Like if I go into Surrey, like to Surrey where I'm from, like to Reigate, the amount of people that will talk about Whispering Angel Rosé like it's something like the best rosé that they could possibly have, and oh, their boss gave them a bottle for Christmas and they feel that it's special. I don't think the way maybe our wine world has evolved that the trickle down effect hasn't happened yet, that still these are really important. Like when it was my mum's 60th, she'd never tried Dom Perignon and she'd been going on about it to my dad for like as long as they've been married, about how one day she'd like to try it, right? Because she wanted to have access to this thing that she'd heard so much about, that when I put a bottle in my fridge and she saw it, she was like, oh, you've got that in there. What's that in there for? I'm like, well, it's obviously for your birthday. She didn't know me well enough to know that I wouldn't be drinking it for myself necessarily. But like for her, that was like a very special moment to be able to have access to this thing that felt in some ways like it's that aspirational piece. It's something she could aspire to having or trying. And I think that's people buy into that still.
Oh, they don't have to have the wine. Basically,
it's the idea of the wine. It's the idea the wine represents.
So you mentioned Whispering Angel. Well, that's a brilliant example of transforming a category through instilling prestige into wines. And so Sacha Lachine, and this has now been bought by LVMH. Interesting, you're talking about the prestige champagnes. They're obviously experts in the luxury goods market. But what Sacha Lachine did was very clever. Whispering Angel is a brand that's basically a négociant rosé that they're making more than 4 million bottles of when I last visited, probably more now, and selling at an elevated price that's beyond the price of
most other region.
Provence rosés. Retail, I think, in the UK is about £16-17. And people have heard of it, and the packaging is fantastic. The wine's pretty good. Doesn't need to be great, just needs to be good enough, I think. But also what he did is extending the brand with the ladders up to the point where this wine that we're trying now, the Garus. And so this is the Garus 2022 from Chateau Desclin. This weighs in at 14.5% alcohol. It's recommended retail price is £120 a bottle. But you can buy it from Berry Brothers and Rudd for £103 a bottle. This is
14.5% for a Provence rosé. This is
pushing rosé into a new stratosphere. And I think there's been other wines now that have tried to match this sort of prestige pricing, but this is positioning something, making something that has organoleptic qualities that are recognized to be high quality. So this is barrel fermented, and they put cooling devices within each barrel to kind of monitor fermentation temperature. Lots of care is taken with this wine. And
I'd love to know the cost of those barrels. American. And they're not cheap.
But what it's about is it's about creating from the ground upwards an expensive wine that fills into this icon category that's pushing the boundaries of, I mean, Domaine Ott were making some pretty smart wines, but they would be like £35 a bottle. And in Provence, this was, I think, the first one to really push the boundaries. And so we'll try it and see what it's like. And I think now you've got Gérard Bertrand with his Clos du Temple.
Yeah.
Which is about €240 retail, which is taking these, that's in Languedoc as well. You know, it's very interesting. So this is like not the market, he didn't release the wine and the market suddenly went crazy and he had to up his price to keep his margin and stop other people getting it. It was expensive from the outset. So,
but also isn't there like those Rock Angel, like there's a whole other range that riff off the Whispering Angel thing as well.
So there's Rock Angel, then there's Chateau d'Eclin, then there's Eclair,
yeah,
and you're climbing the price profile all the time. But the thing that he actually nailed was the packaging. It's like it looks sensational.
Do we really
looks approve a bit like a bank
of that heavy glass?
No, that's another discussion.
Definitely not environmentally like, friendly. No, bottle. This is thick.
Imagine many of the customers aren't too worried about their carbon footprint. Well, they're motoring their yachts out of Saint-Tropez, you know.
Yeah, but expensive wine in expensive bottles. It's the packaging that is all important.
But this actually is quite interesting because if we bring this over to another industry, televisions and television remotes, right? So have you ever noticed that expensive TVs, if you go to a electronic shop, the remotes are always heavily weighted, and they've done that intentionally because people associate the weight with more value, like the weight of gold, like being heavier. That's why there's actually a thing that like people will pick up that bottle and feel that it's better, not knowing that actually has nothing to do with the product inside, right? I did a job in Miami, Florida, where I set up a wine list there about 4 or 5 years ago on South Beach, and I spent a month in Florida working. It's quite interesting. It's so, like, it couldn't be more different to Berlin, London, or maybe anywhere in Europe. But the demand for Whispering Angel in every bar, like if you went to most bars, it was magnums, double magnums. People were ordering them in swimming pools, and they were like double the price than what they are here. But it's a status thing of like, look at me with this big bottle of rosé that you know is really cool. I need to be seen with it. I think the watch comparison is amazing comparison for that. But it really, like, it's mad that in certain places, these wines actually dominate certain markets.
This does taste quite expensive, doesn't it? I mean, it's got this spicy, woody quality that integrates quite well with the very rich pear and peach fruit. It's quite heady.
Ticked a bit of alcohol on that because it does have alcohol. Yeah. This reminds me of I was once a judge at the Decanter World Wine Awards, and we were doing flights of rosé. And to be fair, nothing was sort of scoring very highly with the panel I was on. And the very last wine of the day was some 50 quid Provence Rosé from one of the estates you already mentioned. And I thought, okay, it's not bad, actually. You know, it's a lot of volume in the mouth, you know, very flashy wine. Let's give it a gold and go home. Anyway, so given that we'd given no medals of any description, gold, silver or bronze, this is like quite a departure. The super juror of the day, or the, sort of invigilating our panel, was the great Gérard Basset, and he was begging us to give something a medal, please give something a medal. And we said, Gérard, I think we've got a winner here. I think, you know, like three of us say gold. And he picked up this wine, this pretentious, oaky, overpriced. So he kiboshed the only one we would have given a medal to. And sometimes, like, you think, but that's true in a way, isn't it? It's like it's trying too hard to be to impress you. And surely a rosé is delicious, evanescent, refreshing.
Yeah.
It's like, do I need to sort of sit up or sit back in my chair and be amazed by the winemaking technique? I taste technique in this. There's a lot of technique, I think, as Jamie said. And it is like impressive in a superficial way, in that some wines can be impressive. But then, do we want to be impressed necessarily by wine? Perhaps we don't because of the business we're in.
Or also maybe we're impressed for different reasons.
I'm not in the audience for this wine. I recognise its qualities. It's very well put together in this style. But, you know, it's not necessarily for me. But that's fine because I'm not the audience for this. I can give it a score, and a fair score. But that's that. So maybe we should then turn to the topic of unicorn wines, because I think unicorn wines are quite different.
Can I already open this and we just at least pour it without mentioning it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Cause it'd be nice to actually.
We have one of the unicorn of all unicorns.
Courtesy unicorn of with hen's teeth.
Yes.
Our hen has teeth.
Yes.
So
it even sounds different when it's poured.
Well, we'll come to this in a moment.
Okay, so what is...
What's a unicorn wine? Emily, what would you say unicorn wine is?
I would say a unicorn wine is a rare wine that's highly desired, where there's a big demand for it. It's the scarcity factor is very high. And sometimes, I think you mentioned cult wines. A unicorn could be a cult wine, but not every unicorn is a cult wine. Not every cult wine is a unicorn. Freudian slip, I'll have to dig into that later. In the case of what we're trying now, I'd definitely say this would be both a unicorn and a cult wine.
But, I think scarcity is one of the key things, because obviously there aren't that many unicorns out in the wild. So that's the name suggests that it's like, are you sure this actually exists? Because we can't get hold of it. I think scarcity is definitely a factor, but scarcity coupled with demand, because obviously you could make 30 bottles of a wine, and unless someone's demanding it, then you can't really call it a unicorn. It's just a...
No one will have heard of it.
One of 30 bottles. Yes. Yeah.
And quite interesting, going on to the economic piece, because you mentioned it before around how with a lot of icons, the winemakers already pitched that wine at this high price point that it doesn't necessarily get flipped for more, maybe. With unicorn wines, these are the wines often, sometimes we're seeing on the secondary market much more, where they like multiply. Over what the price of what the winemaker sells to the importer, maybe much more than icons.
I think they acquire a mythological status and a mystery behind them, which is sort of amplified by people sharing stories about wines that they've possibly never even tried. So I think the difference, I mean, for me, a unicorn, and this is entirely subjective, is usually a rare wine which has some real value, some intrinsic value, rather than a reputational value, which is what icons do. So it doesn't mean that every unicorn is a great wine, but I think the effort and precision in terms of farming and winemaking makes these wines beautiful and unique. And that's what, in a way, confers extra status upon them.
So maybe it's a good time to mention the wine that's now in our glasses, because this maybe is one of the most relevant unicorns in our current time.
Yes. Doug, tell us about this wine.
So this is Domaine de Miroir in the southern part of the Jura region. The grape variety is Chardonnay on sort of limestone. And
the cuvée name?
Is Sonorité du Vent. And the vintage is 2019. And the winemaker is Kenjiro Kagami, Japanese producer who first worked in Cornas. I think he worked in Cornas. I don't want to probably untrue. And then sort of like bought a little, like a bit of a vineyard from Jean-François Ganivard, and currently farms around three to four hectares, planted to a mixture of Chardonnay, Sauvignon, Trousseau and Broussard. Makes a tiny bit of red. Mainly Chardonnay, a little bit of Sauvignon, and in a more modern style of Jura, in the sense that everything is topped up, there's no sort of Sauvignon Blanc style. But for all that, and yes, this is Jura, and Jura in itself is like got unicorn iconic status, cult status, but the wines themselves are completely unique. Going back to what we said in a previous episode about terroir, there's something about these wines, and I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the winemaker, but they have this umami sense mixed occasionally with a reductive character, and there's an incredible interplay. The wines are very sort of always constantly moving in the glass between reduction and sort of like the savoury element, back and forth. It would be very interesting. the wines have fantastic acidity as well, natural acidity. It'd be very interesting to sort of decant this wine, serve it across an evening, try to pretend it was like, you know, evolving over 5 to 10 years to see what character comes out. But I suggest, and when I'm tasting this, it goes back in its shell, it peeps out, goes back in its shell, peeps out. This is intriguing and enchanting. And I think that a lot of people, when they buy a wine, they don't want like this block of flavour, which is six glasses of identical wine. They want one wine that is multifaceted. Protean literally can be six different glasses of wine or 10 different glasses of wine. That to me is rare, like a unicorn. I mean, well, unicorns are rare. They don't exist, sorry. That rarely exists in a wine, that it can evolve like so incredibly. It can be transparent and yet incredibly deep as well. And I find it sort of enchanting. And sometimes I'm not even sure whether I like the wines, you know, or love the wine, but I'm totally involved in it, totally enveloped by the aromas and flavours.
When you describe that, it made me think of the first time I tried the white Mungibel from Frank Cornelison, but a while ago, like 10 years ago. And it was like opening this lava lamp wine and then really going on a journey of like sometimes a really strong dislike and then other moments of intrigue. And it was a challenging wine, actually, for me. And I wonder as well, when you said something along the lines of people want a wine that's like changing. I don't know if everybody wants that. I think some of us do. Other people find that terrifying, a wine like this. Like, because if I think there's quite a lot of conditioning of having like expecting wine to be this homogenous product from a consumer, let's say a guest perspective sometimes. I think for the nerds like us, and definitely like I speak for myself in this sense, like the journey of this, like understanding the facets, it's a little bit like getting to know a person. Like when I sit here with you, maybe you've got a view or a habit that you do that's a bit annoying, right?
Yes.
But there's like other things.
I know.
But there's other things that are like truly wonderful about you and very alluring, where I'm like, I need to know more about that. Looking at the picture of a whole, like an unsymmetrical face that becomes more intriguing, that like the mole that's on the cheek or something like that actually becomes part of the beauty of a product.
That's because I'm a unicorn and not an icon. If you want consistency.
You actually are a true definition of a unicorn. Yeah. I know no one anywhere close to
you. If you want consistency, like icons are brands. I think I would not say Domaine de Miroir is a brand. I'd say it is something of itself. And, you know, the fact that its intangibility is what makes it the unicorn. It's like you're reaching after something that is so evanescent. It's so sort of like extraordinary and playful. That I think that's what I think we like. I'm not saying everyone likes it, but I'm not saying everyone would necessarily like this wine. If you want consistency, you're not going to get consistency from glass to glass.
Well, an icon chaser.
Well, from sip
if
to
they
sip
see
even.
This wine at the current market price of this, they might a rich person might buy this and take it onto their yacht in Saint-Tropez, and then be very disappointed because it doesn't meet their expectations at all. Because this is not a beginner's wine. This has got a little hint of volatile acidity that works really well.
Yeah, it gives that almost sweetness
to the acid line. But this is a wine for contemplation by people who...
The unicorn. It's like you're reaching after something that is so evanescent. It's so sort of like extraordinary and playful that I think that's what I think we like. I'm not saying everyone likes it, but I'm not saying everyone would necessarily like this wine. If you want consistency... You're not going to get consistency from glass to glass.
Well, an icon chaser.
Well, from sip to sip.
If they
sip
see
even.
This wine at the current market price of this, they might a rich person might buy this and take it onto their yacht in Saint-Tropez, and then be very disappointed because it doesn't meet their expectations at all. Because this is not a beginner's wine. This has got a little hint of volatile acidity that works really well.
Yeah, it gives that almost sweetness
to the acid line. But this is a wine for contemplation by people who really love wine. And this is where we need to recognise, well, talk about the reality of the secondary marketplace for wines, and especially natural wines. Because for me, this jars. The idea that someone is selling this, you know, he's not looking at the market price and then setting his price. He's setting his price, you know,
for what it's worth.
For
yes.
what he a fair price for this product. And if I was making wine like this, I'd feel very upset that to see it being someone else making a huge margin on it. I remember researching an article about this for Little Wine. Christine asked me to write about the natural wine and the secondary market. And this was a great example because one major retailer in the UK had all these wines. This is a couple of years back, retailing at £600. And I checked with you, Doug, and you hadn't supplied these wines to them. So they bought them on the secondary market. And then, as a retailer, as a famous fine wine retailer, they decided this is the market price of these wines, going to sell them at that price. And I think that's like, I feel very uneasy about that because it's like, and now you showed me earlier that there's one really good retailer in the UK that has this on their site for £1,015 for a bottle. So they bought that from you for, I think the price has gone up.
Did they buy it directly price, from you?
The trade okay. price, so
oh,
you
that's ridiculous.
They've got the wine for $60, yeah, and they're selling it for £1,015, and I think that's, you know what, they probably only got one bottle, so they're trying to make the most of it. But it just feels to me
unethical.
It just feels like the wine grower should be making that money, and not the retail chain.
Totally.
And it's like, this is the sort of people who are going to splash £1,000 for a bottle of wine are going to be disappointed with this wine generally. This is not their wine. This is not...
This is the problem with price comparison websites, is that people in the end know the value of... No, what is it? Like the cost of... the price of everything.
And the value of nothing. Yes.
I noticed that one pretty famous fine wine merchant was selling a Miroir wine, like three bottles, at £1,800. So the £1,000 one was not expensive, relatively speaking. And I looked at the cuvée, and it's a really hardcore orange wine that they make called I Need the Sun. I'm thinking, like, the person who buys this wine eventually is going to be shocked when they open it. And then I thought,
maybe they're not going to open it.
They're going to sell it on a tertiary market, maybe. And so, like, what started as £1,000 and ends up as £2,000 or £3,000, and no one is tasting the wine, and so it gets traded like a Bordeaux index markets, and it has an index of value, which, as Jamie says, it's like it's a £60 wine, and if anyone deserves the credit, it's the vigneron. But the vigneron is too humble to sort of like suggest that this is the wine that he should be selling at X pounds per whatever. And I do know that a lot of Jura vignerons are heartily pissed off with this sort of secondary market, because in a way, of course, you make wine for people to drink, not for people to yes. trade, like playing cards.
There's this a slightly cynical opinion I have on this, which I wouldn't mind share, is that don't you also think, I mean, when we say the person that gets that bottle, £1,000 or £1,500, or whatever it is, that they're going to be disappointed. Do you really think that person paying that bottle, buying it kind of blindly, is even going to know that this isn't what they want? Like, do you actually think, are they discerning enough that they're even going to think about it? Like, because maybe they're so attached with the idea. Like, is that a possibility? And then the next point, or maybe question, open question to you both, is any wine worth that money?
I would say, I have a limit how much I'll pay for a bottle, and it's well below that. I think, generally speaking, I mean, I do buy wine quite a lot.
Yeah.
And probably the most I spend is in restaurants, but my ceiling is around £100 in a restaurant. So pretty much every good restaurant has got really interesting wines for £100 or less.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I look for the bottle of wine which delivers the most flavour for the least amount of money. And then you make discoveries because you realise you don't have to pay hundreds of pounds. I wonder if some people, he wonders parenthetically, whether some people, when they taste an expensive bottle of wine, let's say a Bordeaux from a Cru Classé, whether they taste it to be better than it is. They want it to be really good. So the wine tastes great. They want Dom Perignon to be great, you know, life-altering experience. They taste it. They think, yeah, it's a luxury thing. And I feel really good about this. Whereas this wine, I mean, I'm not saying the other wines aren't have some sort of intellectual value. This wine is quite an intellectual, difficult wine, as Jamie said. And if you're not prepared to engage at that level, if you put yourself in front of the wine rather than letting the wine come to you, trying to experience it at as deep and subtle level as you can, then I think you're going to miss it. And you're going to wonder why it's so expensive. But it wasn't intended to be expensive. It's intended to be a pure example of what it is. But it can't be put in the box. It's a natural wine. You know, it's like made without anything and, you know, the result of phenomenal farming. But if you don't think that's what wine should be, then it's not going to be interesting to you. But if you think that wine should be this sort of block of flavour that you can talk about it, identify it, it's really clear, you can communicate about it very easily, then that's your bag, and you'll probably enjoy a wine which is even very expensive. Because for me, it's the opposite way around. I don't want to know it. If I do know it really quickly, I feel like ripped off because there's nowhere to go with the wine. I want to have to tease out the meaning of something. It's like great poetry or great art. If it's just like a cartoon or you can see it instantly, what's the point? But if you have to look and look and look again, or taste and taste and taste again, that for me is the definition of a unicorn. It's something really, really intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that in terms of my approach to wines like this, and actually just the kind of wines I love, and they don't necessarily need to be unicorns, right, for that. But I just wonder if the person spending $1,000 in a restaurant, if they're even looking for a block of flavour. I think there are those people that are looking for that. They want the concentration, the thing, and all of that, where it's like it feels like that heavy watch or that heavy remote or whatever. But do you, like, I wonder as well if there are people that just like, oh yeah, I've got this, I've heard that's good, I'm just going to pay it, that they don't even engage with the wine even enough, that it's just like, it's a bit like the Blossom Hill drinker, but like the pendulum on the other end of the spectrum of just like, I'm just consuming it, I'm just spending a significantly more amount of money on it.
Think about an area where you don't have category expertise, but you shop in occasionally. I'm trying to think. So, like, for instance, I quite like coffee, but I've not got category expertise in coffee. And if I wanted a really great experience of coffee, I might be tempted to go somewhere that offers me super expensive coffee that's rare. And part of my thrill of that experience will just be that I'm tasting something that's rare and expensive. And I actually like it or not, or whether I understand it, is separate. I'm just kind of curious to try something that's kind of talked about and rare and expensive. So we're kind of going to the icon territory a little bit, as well as with the sort of the unicorn territory sort of
there's status. The blurred line again.
But, you know, I think there is a blurred line a bit, because I remember with an example of this, like, so somebody doing nicely with rare wines, like, for instance, the Ganevar stuff now is bundled. So Lake Havre, when you sell it in cases of 12, where you get maybe one or two bottles of Ganevar with a load of other really good wines as well. Was that?
No, I mean, we had to do that during lockdown.
That was during lockdown, because I remember I bought, like, I tried getting some cases from Lake Havre, and they said, no, you can't have them. It's like, it's so hard to get hold of. You know, it's and so actually a trade colleague went and got a couple of cases on my behalf.
obviously weren't emailing.
I'm not important enough. No, I'm not important enough. And but anyway, so because actually they got the offer. I didn't see the offer. This trade colleague got the offer and said, "Can Jamie get a case as well?" Then the person who was at Le Car said, "No, he can't. It's just for you guys." Mm-hmm. So he got one for me. But anyway, so the idea of the bundling. So remember going
who
to
you know.
I didn't go the right way. Obviously, I didn't think of that. I went down to this restaurant in St. Leonard's near Hastings called Farmyard.
Oh yeah.
Which is a fantastic place, like and we were there, and we saw on the top shelf there was some Ganevar, right? They've got a really good wine list anyway. It's like the sort of thing where the wines are on the shelf and they've got prices marked on them. And there's plenty of fun you can have there but I saw the Ganevar, so I asked the guy, I said, "Those for sale?" He said, "I better ask my wife." And so he called his wife and he said, "Yeah, you can buy one of those. But you've got to drink it here." So that's fine. Yeah, yeah. So so we chose one. It was a Chardonnay. I can't remember what it was. And I was like, I didn't ask the price. And then when the bill came, it was like £96, which is like not retail reasonable. Price plus 20 or something. You know, it's like, or probably retail price. And I thought, good on you. I was expecting to be hit with 200 for that bottle. But they actually did the respectful thing and they sold it. To be drunk, you know, which is, I think, ultimately what, if you're a wine grower, You want to make a living, yeah? But beyond that, you want your wines to go to places where they're being drunk rather than being traded by speculators. And I think this is a... Maybe I'm too old-fashioned about this, but it's like, you know, kind of you're certainly in the natural wine, authentic wine, wine with that makeup ecosystem that we tend to spend a lot of time in. It's a human thing. It's about values. It's about respect. It's about almost a spiritual appreciation of wine as much as let's see how much money we can make. We're not in this business definitely to make as much money as we can. We're in this business because it's really interesting and we want to make a living because we need to survive the sustainability. But I think it's that sort of sense of fairness and playing nicely really matters. And when people come in and they just buy the wines or get the wines on grey market and then just see how much they can wring out of the market for those wines, I think it's deeply disrespectful to the growers. But it's also interesting that, like, for instance, Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, when they sell wines in the UK through Corney & Barrow, their agent, they take quite a lot of measures to try and stop people just flipping the wines because they're selling the wines at a high price, but it's below the market price. And so the bottles are all numbered. If you get an allocation from Corney & Barrow, the understanding is that should you need to sell the wines...
There's a ledger.
You sell it back to Corney & Barrow in the first instance. And should you decide to sell the wines within 2 years of having bought them, Corney & Barrow will assume you're not a genuine buyer, you're a speculator,
you won't get any more
allocations. So it's very much a sense of, we want these wines to go to people who are going to drink them, not people who are going to trade them. But they also make sure they sell a lot of wines to restaurants as well. And the really extreme example is Charles Lachaud. He does some very, I think Noble Rotta, that they're Keeling Andrew are doing the agency for him now. But his expectations are very, very extreme about how he wants these wines just to go onto restaurant wine lists. And every bottle is traced. And it's the idea that this is wines that people should be drinking.
Yeah, but Jamie, to challenge that a little bit, I agree with you that there's, we know that's a fact, but how does somebody who's a grower with a finite budget and finite amount of time and their small scale, how does he do that? Like, that's not possible for every unicorn producer, right, to have that traceability.
But I think the good thing is selling to Le Carve,
who
don't do the gouging.
Yeah.
But then I guess it's Le Carve's job to choose who they sell to.
That's so different. Like Auvenoir, you work
with... How do you deal with that? Yeah.
In the end, because it's such a finite product that you learn over the years, who are what we call the magpies, the people who just want the glittering jewels, you only see them once a year or twice a year. And they sort of descend on you when they hear about these particular products. Now, if we're allocating one or two bottles, because that's all we have to play with per account, it's not of interest to a fine wine merchant to stick a bottle on a website. Yeah, they may make £500 on it, but it doesn't interest us either, because that wine won't be drunk by anyone that we know. Whereas if you give it to a restaurant or sell it to a restaurant, you know that someone will order it and enjoy it, like your experience with Farmyard. We had some Miroir open. At Terroir, when it was just before about to close, and Auvenoir and stuff like that. And we opened it by the glass because we didn't want anyone to buy a bottle, but we wanted it to be accessible to as many people as possible.
That's very cool.
Selling it at a
normal margin, but by the glass.
So you could buy a glass for £20.
Or do it on Coravan or something.
Yeah. I mean, like,
I don't know how that would be under Coravan, that wine.
There's something so the spontaneity of having a wine open. But there were people there. We got wise to this because there were people there who literally, when they heard, before we decided to do the Miroir by the glass, the Auvenoir by the glass, we were doing it by the bottle at a sort of very reasonable price. The people there, individuals would come, sit at the bar and just order one bottle of that, one bottle of the Auvenoir, one bottle of Ganema, and just drink it like camels, as if they could take it with them into the next world, which is probably where they were going, or just store it for years. And I think, you're not enjoying the wine, though. I mean, it's just because you're drinking it doesn't mean you possess it.
Yes.
You don't possess its soul or its spirit because you've consumed it. And it's such a weird thing to do. I think, enjoyment is in a way, you have to treat every wine on its merits and make sure you're in the right situation to get the most out of it. And sometimes it'll disappoint you, and sometimes it'll give you an epiphany.
But you know, it's interesting. I had an experience. I won't name the place. I won't shame the place. But it was one of the first modern day natural wine bars in Hackney. And it was after one of the real wine fairs. And I was actually there with a bunch of growers. And I think I was there with David, your colleague, and a bunch of Spanish growers. And we were there and we were really, really into drinking a bunch of Jura stuff, right? So we ordered a few bits And I think actually Mads, who's the sommelier at Noma, he was there too. So there was a real nice bunch of us. And we were obviously like the best crowd for like wine appreciation, like natural wine producers, sommeliers who love natural wine, ordering natural wine and like nerding out about it around a table, right? Some bottles came and when I looked at the wine list, I had been there maybe three or four weeks before, and I had drank a bottle of Auvernoir. Poulsard, which is one of my desert island wines, but now I'm kind of a bit resentful about it because I can never drink it anymore. Like I haven't drunk it for a couple of years now. She can't find any bottles anywhere, and then if you do find them anywhere, they're so overpriced that you're like, I'm not going to buy them. But at this point, because it was maybe like 8 years ago, on a wine list it would be around £80-85, right? Mm-hmm. And every time I saw it, I was like, oh, this is a celebration moment, I can't wait to drink this. And it would never be a bottle I would drink alone, except one time I did order it alone in Japan, but I shared it with the staff, because I feel like with these wines, they're not wines you should be greedy about. They are wines that you should share with people to really make it a moment and make it meaningful. Anyway, we're there, we're ordering a bunch of wines, and when we go out to pay the bill, one of the wines was out of stock that we had ordered, and we got offered something else. Then when we went to pay the bill, it was much more expensive, right? And he was like, oh, well, yeah, but this wine, the wine that we replaced it with is much more expensive. It's like, oh, you could have let me know. And I made a kind of snarky remark, because when I looked at the wine list, I saw Auvernoir Poulsard on the list for £170 at a time when it was £80 to £90 everywhere else. And I just made this little comment of like, I would have ordered that instead, but then I realised it wasn't a Magnum. So I decided not to order that, which is why we took your team's recommendation. And I got really a little bit like bitchy about it. But it was to really make a point, because I actually just felt like it's irresponsible to be doing that. If you're talking all about like, I'm an independent place, I've got these values, I care about these growers. If you're overpricing wine, that doesn't necessarily reflect that. And I think I'm personally quite sensitive to it, because I think in the wine world, there's such a strong sense of community that when somebody doesn't act in a way that's community driven, it feels very edgy and very uncomfortable.
It's like a betrayal.
Yeah.
But also, I don't see the point. When you have one or two bottles of wine, you know, what is the point in selling it for a huge amount of money? I think you want to make wines like this as accessible as possible. We work with a gastropub in Islington, and guy puts a cash
Draper's
margin.
Arms.
Yeah, Draper's
right,
Arms.
Right, Draper's
and I, you
arms.
Know, Nick was telling me, Nick from Draper's, that when he put the Miroir on the list for, I think it was 100 and something pounds, 50, 40, it's like incredible. By far the cheapest you'd find in London, I'm guessing, that a person who's having their birthday there saw it on the list and almost wept tears of gratitude.
Yeah.
You can't buy that sort of moment, I think, and that's, wouldn't you like to give someone like extreme pleasure rather than know that you'd rip them off? I mean, for me, it's a
win-win for everybody,
of course. Yes. Yeah, and that mentality. But I mean, I think it's also an ethical thing. I hate wines being overpriced. I respect the work that goes into a wine, but I still think wine is a drink for us all, you know, and that we should all have the chance or opportunity. If there was enough wine for a unicorn wine, if there was enough of it, we could all afford to buy a bottle in our lifetime rather than like hunt it to extinction or pay through a sort of third party some obscene price.
I think there's a point where I guess a healthy attitude towards the icons is when you see them, so the unicorns is when you see them and they're affordably priced, that's joyful. Enjoy them. Some wines become out of reach. Some wines become impossible to find. Some wines, it's kind of like are no longer available to us. And that's the point where we have to have peace and go and make our own discoveries, because there are so many great wines out there. holding that sort of tension between loving the chase of the unattainable and finding it and attaining it, and yet at the same time just loving the qualities of the wines you come across that aren't famous, and being able to participate in that tasting experience and imbue value into that wine because it's really good. And it doesn't matter that it's not widely recognized, this wine is amazing. But if you find something amazing, be able to have that joy in appreciating the qualities of that wine and being fully satisfied without the need of the approval of the fact that the people are hunting for this.
Well, isn't this true of icon wines as well? I mean, we all drink Grover Champagne, and yet sommeliers will ask us, well, I think things are changing now. Sommeliers will ask for a brand and support with the brand. The number of sommeliers who've asked us for a very expensive rosé of a certain name, which is £40 a bottle. And if you say, but we've got a wonderful biodynamic rosé from Provence, which is £20, they're not interested, right? Because they think they're responding to their customers who are aspiring to drink a famous name. They're not aspiring to drink a better wine, though, which is quite odd. So we've got a lot of overpriced wines on lists throughout the world because they're aspirational and not real. Whereas I think the unicorn wines, well, they're real wines. I mean, but they may be so rare, and unfortunately, a lot of people are pricing them ridiculously because of their rarity and not for any other reason. Mm. They just want to make, you know, they're saying, well, I might as well make a profit on it, because why wouldn't I want to make a profit on it? Rather than looking the other way around, is why wouldn't I like to give someone an amazing experience at a reasonable price?
Well, I think to finish this episode off, because we're running near the end of our time limit, we should give a little toast.
Yeah.
To all those...
But maybe give Doug a little bit more, sorry, because you've short-poured him.
Oh, that happens to be in restaurants all the time.
So, a toast to a true unicorn.
Yes.
Douglas Reg.
Yes. Sir Doug.
I'm feeling like a unicorn tonight.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed this episode. You can stay in touch with us by finding us on Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast.
Well remembered.
Thank you. I'm Emily Harman.
I'm Jamie Good.
And I'm Doug Gregg.
Cheers.
Cheers.